Hello, welcome to Sonic Tonic. I'm Greg Perret, and I'm extending a very warm welcome to all of you who are listening. I'll be bringing you music, interviews, and special features from the world of jazz and blues. This podcast is brought to you by the California Jazz Foundation. It's a nonprofit that assists California musicians who have given their lives to this music but have fallen on rough times. Our podcast will reflect the talent, the journeys, and the insights of a wide range of musical artists. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a Sonic Tonic. The next few episodes of Sonic Tonic are going to focus on those LA venues where great jazz was and still is performed. For this first installment of this series, I'm going to feature a club that's very special to me. It's called the Baked Potato and is located in a place called Studio City, very near Universal Studios in Los Angeles. Now, the lifeblood of this venue is its owner and founder, pianist Don Randy. Now, once I open up the Don Randy book, I've got to talk about a group of amazing musicians whose roots were primarily in jazz. They changed the music scene in LA in the 60s, and what they pioneered in the recording industry is with us to this very day. Now, this bunch of musicians that Don was an integral part of was called the Wrecking Crew, and I was very fortunate to know many of them, as well as being mentored by two of them, guitarist Tommy Tedesco and pianist Mike Melvoin. Okay, I'm going to start with the Wrecking Crew and work my way back to the Baked Potato. As we all know, rock and roll was exploding in the 50s and 60s, and LA was one of its primary hubs. Recording studios were going 24/7, and the demand for product was enormous. Most of the iconic artists from that era required the services of very talented musicians to turn those recordings into hit records. Enter the Wrecking Crew, a fraternity of primarily journeyman jazz musicians who, sensing a golden opportunity to make some money, provided the musical underpinnings for those hit records coming out of Los Angeles. If I go any deeper into this topic of the Wrecking Crew, this podcast is going to be about 5 hours long, so I'm simply going to say, Google and watch the documentary film called The Wrecking Crew. It's eye-opening about that period of time. Okay, Don was part of that fraternity. When I was a teenager back in the early 60s, that's when I first met him through my sister Anita. Don was working as a pianist at the various jazz venues along the Sunset Strip and doing recording sessions for everyone from producer Phil Spector to artists like Sonny and Cher. That notoriety and income enabled him to start his own club in 1969, which he called the Baked Potato. The club soon became a haven for musician royalty, as well as those young musicians getting started trying to make a name for themselves. Don was performing at the Baked Potato in November of 2021, and I had a chance to go and hear him. Even though Don is in his 80s now, he still plays with the energy and enthusiasm of an 18-year-old, but with the wisdom of 60-plus years' experience of being one of the most important studio musicians in Los Angeles during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was a great treat for me to reconnect, hear him play, and reminisce. It's also a real honor for me to bring you the story of the Baked Potato as told by its founder, Don Randy. Now, I need to apologize ahead of time, though. The interview was wonderful, but unfortunately the phone connection wasn't the best. So when you hear muffled or static sounds, it's not your equipment. Again, my apologies, I did my best to correct Don's sound quality. Hello, Don Randy.
Hi, Greg. How are you, my friend?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. Don, the next few Sonic Tonic episodes are going to be about the various iconic jazz venues that still exist in L.A., and I want to start with your place, the Baked Potato. Now, I can't talk about the Baked Potato without talking about you, and I can't talk about you without talking about the Wrecking Crew. So the path I want to follow is Don Randy the musician, Don Randy the Wrecking Crew alum, and Don Randy the nightclub owner.
I'm hated by everybody. What can I tell you? It's been an interesting trek. Not always the happiest times, especially with this past year.
Yeah.
But I would say, generally speaking, I couldn't ask for it any better. It's been that wonderful, you know, for all these years. People don't realize how tough it is to run a business, especially in the state of California. You're dealing with the county, the city, just keeps right on going.
Yeah, man, the taxes and permits have to be brutal. You know, I remember when I was a teenager, that's when I first met you, and I remember you were playing a lot of clubs up and down the Sunset Strip.
That's correct. That's when I first started. Wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, were you doing record dates while you were playing in these clubs?
I didn't do my first record date till 1963.
Yeah, yeah. Who was the date for?
My date was for Phil Spector. Steve Douglas was his contractor, and he was a close friend of mine, saxophone player. He did all the, we used to call him Teenage Steve. He played all those simple baritone lines or tenor lines on a lot of Phil Spector's records.
Yeah.
And he worked my weddings and bar mitzvahs. You know, in those days, you took any gig you could get.
Right.
And in 1957, I started at Sherry's, which was the nightclub on the Sunset Strip.
Yes, I remember it.
People would come in there, and he brought Phil Spector in there to see me one night. And Phil, the next thing I know, Steve says, "You want to do a recording date?" I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, come on." And we went. And I wish I could say I was the only piano player there. There was four of us. Myself, a pianist by the name of Ray Johnson, who was Plaz Johnson's brother.
Yeah.
And Lincoln Majorca was... Lincoln wasn't on that one. A guy from New York by the name of Mike Spencer, who was a classical concertizer who grew up at Fairfax High School with Phil.
Yeah.
And I think Al DeLore was the other one. He
wow.
was another piano player.
Wow.
And there was four of us on that date. You know, that was the first one. He's a Rebel.
Wow. That was the Crystals, 1962.
Yeah.
That's rock and roll history.
You know, before that, I played a myriad of nightclubs in Los Angeles. And the first one was the best gig anybody could have ever had starting out. It was on 6th Street near Western Avenue.
Yeah.
It was called Marianne's Surf Club.
Yeah.
And she loved jazz, and she had a small concert grand in there that she kept in tune. And no one was allowed to play that piano if they weren't a pianist.
Yeah.
You couldn't just go and sit there. And she had piano trios, quartets. And on Sundays, she had open jam sessions. And the first time I ever played and sat in with anybody was on a session at her club.
Wow.
And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I had no idea. I was working for a record distributor, California Record Distributors. I was a stock boy and shipper.
Mm-hmm.
So all day long, I listened to East Coast jazz and West Coast jazz. It was wonderful because there was such a gigantic difference between the both.
Yes.
So it was pretty, pretty interesting. And then one thing led to another, and I started working some little gigs. And she said to me, "Why don't you work here 5 nights a week?" And I said, "Oh, my God, I really?" And I, you know what? I worked for her. And this was like her name was Marianne Kirk. She was Irish, but it was an Italian pizza spaghetti place that you got. And once the band started playing, the waitresses and the waiters that were in there had to be very quiet. And if she was there and somebody was talking while you were playing a ballad, she would walk over and say, "Do you mind? These gentlemen are expressing themselves." What a concept, huh?
Man, you did luck up. That's a sweet gig. You don't find owners like that.
Absolutely. Of course, after that, everything was downhill. And she had two of the most gorgeous daughters that worked there also. So that was also really nice. And everybody was so kind to us, you know.
Wow. So were you doing solo or was it an ensemble?
No, it was with a drummer by the name of Don Clauder.
Mm-hmm.
And at that, we had the worst bass player in the world. His name was Ronnie Retchin. He would get the gigs all the time, these different gigs that we'd get, because he looked like he was 40 and he was only 15 or 16. But he managed. He was not what we like, you know, as a bass player.
I understand.
But he managed and it helped us. And then he lasted about 2 years, and then he went on to some computer science thing, I think.
I got you.
But John Clauder became... he's still gone, and he's 80-something. And he has a band. They go out with Christian music.
Mm-hmm.
They're called Drums of Fire. It has five percussionists that go all over the world with this thing. It's pretty wild. And he ended up playing drums for loads of different people. And the first time I met him, he had a little sideline part on a Disney show on TV. With Cubby O'Brien, was that his name?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And John was the other drummer that would come on that show with Disneyland. What was that called? Mickey Mouse Club. So that's how far back we go. It was the best time to grow up. I'll tell you, there was so many places to work.
Yeah.
And you talk about nightclubs and restaurants. On the Sunset Strip, there was at least, I'd say, between Robertson Boulevard and Western Avenue. And this is a lowball, at least 20 different places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
At least there. And they all had live music.
Yeah.
You'd get down Western Avenue at it, Vermont Avenue at it.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was some on Fairfax at that point, but not much. But mostly it was on Sunset or Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, you know, when I was coming up, I caught the tail end of it. I could see L.A. had a vibrant scene for live music.
I'll tell you, when PJ's opened up, which was Santa Monica and Crescent Heights,
right.
that was an important gig because it was like the hit place for the Hollywood people, the people that were writing in The Reporter. They all went there.
Right.
So if you got spotted there, you got your name in the paper. And you know how that goes for the actors, the young actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. That was totally important, extremely important. And when we first started, I got a gig there because of Joe Michaelis. Joe heard me play at Sherry's and said, "You got to come work for me."
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't say, "Will you come work for me?" He says, "You got to come work for me."
Yeah.
And so that's how it started. And he and I became real good friends and stayed buddies till he passed away.
Boy, that's a name I haven't heard in a long time.
Well, he loved your sister. I mean, he was the one, he said, "Where do you hear this girl singing? Where do you hear her song?"
Well, I was a kid, and it really was an exciting time for me.
It was.
So, Don, you know, how did all of this translate over to the Wrecking Crew?
Well, we were called the Wall of Sound first, Greg. The Phil Spector. That's what we were. There was no Wrecking Crew. How to become the Wrecking Crew? We were the guys that came in. I mean, everybody smoked in the studios. They didn't wear suits and ties. And all the other guys up to this point, everybody was always dressed properly. And, you know, and here we come in playing rock and roll and doing all this stuff, and we could care less and joking around. I mean, we didn't take it very seriously. It was serious, but we could work over a producer if we saw that he was a moron, you know? And we did.
Yeah, you guys were the bad boys, but you set a very high standard for recording that exists to this day.
This is actually how it happened. One of the suit guys said, "Those guys are going to wreck the business." And that's how we got the Wrecking Crew.
Well, it's still going strong.
Also, mind you, we did 21 million selling records in a row.
Wow.
For Phil. And then Brian Wilson heard Be My Baby, and he told Steve, "I got to have those guys. Those guys, I got to have those guys. I don't want anybody else but those guys."
Yeah, you know, my first impression of the Wrecking Crew was that at its core, we're a bunch of journeyman jazz musicians who knew how to improvise, think on the fly, and it seemed like that was a perfect mix for rock and roll at that time.
Absolutely. And a lot of the guys hated the music. I mean, they were getting paid well for it, you know, or decent. And I loved it right from the get. I remember the first time I had my radio on and I heard "He's a Rebel." I had to pull my car over and say, "I played on that." And there was four of us, you know. The Wall of Sound, everybody playing the same part at different octaves of the piano, you know.
Yeah.
That's how Phil would do it. Spread everybody out in that echo chamber at Gold Star. The same thing with the guitar players.
Oh, yeah.
You being a guitarist, you would have enjoyed Phil because he had the capability of going out and telling Tommy Tedesco, "Can you do it on this fret? Barney Kessel, could you do it on this fret? Can you put a capo on? I want an open sound out of your guitar."
Right.
He understood the guitar probably better than any producer. I shouldn't say better than anybody. I'm sure there were guys that did the same thing, but not with that capability. The only one that ever complained about it was Howard Roberts.
Oh.
Howard actually walked out of the date. He got so, you know, we played the same thing over and over and over again, sometimes 7-8 hours, you know. And Howard said, "I can't keep my hand in that position anymore. I'm cramping."
Yeah.
And he got up and he told Phil, "Why don't you come out and play it? You keep telling everybody you know what you want." And he picked up his amp and walked out.
I know that one.
He just said, "I'll see you."
Look, I've done a couple of those myself. I get that one.
As tough as he was with us, he wouldn't let Hal or Earl, whoever the drummer was, He wouldn't let him start doing the fill. When you started saying, okay, now I can hear some fills, you knew it was getting near. He would let the drummer wait because he liked to end his fade outs on all his records had lots of drum fills. And that's what he would do. So you knew when the drum fills started to play the fills that we were getting close to making it a take.
Oh, this is a great insight.
And Hal, incidentally, was the only guy, the only drummer out of all of them, I take that back. Carlos Vega later on, and so did Chet McCracken. When they would come in, the first thing they do, they'd go around the toms and the snare, and they'd tune.
Yeah.
He would tune. He'd hear where the vocal was going to be, and Hal would tune to make it sympathetic vibration-wise with what the vocal, where the key was.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I didn't work much with Hal Blaine. I didn't do a bunch of sessions with him, but the ones I did, I really enjoyed. But Earl Palmer, man, he was a good friend to me and my son. Yeah, I love that guy.
Oh, Earl Palmer was like, how can I describe it? Soft butter on bread. Man, he was so easy to play with, you know. And they did not play alike. They were completely different players, Earl and Hal. And always says, well, they did the same dates. Yes, they did, but they did not play alike. Earl had his thing and Hal had his thing.
Right.
And then Johnny Guerin and then Jimmy Gordon. I think Jimmy Gordon, had he not gotten in the trouble he got into, would have wiped everybody out. That's how good he played. He was wonderful.
Well, I work with John, and like I said, Earl was a dear friend and a great mentor. You know, but the person that influenced me the most as a player and as a person was Tommy Tedesco.
Yeah.
Yeah, also my first serious guitar teacher really pointed me in the right direction. He exposed me to both classical and jazz technique, which was unusual because most players only played one or the other. His name was Nick Bonney. Did you know him?
Sure, I know who that was. Yeah, I remember. He was in town. Actually, he did some recording. You started at a good time. You started at a real good time. But you always loved your craft. You were a musician, not just a player. You know, you liked the musicality of it, not just the guitar playing. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That always appealed to me. And that's the other thing where I thought the Wrecking Crew was brilliant. It's that you always made it musical no matter what the genre was.
Sure. What helped me, believe it or not, throughout my career is having my kids being younger than me. Because they would say, Dad, listen to this or listen to this. I remember the first time David played the Mahavishnu Orchestra, I said, what the was that? And he said, listen to that drummer, man.
So switching gears a bit, Don, when did you get the bug to start a club of your own?
Well, I'll tell you what, working for the guy I worked for at Sherry's, and one year I had about $5,200 worth of substitute piano players.
Wow.
I wasn't there. So he said to me, why don't you get your own club, and then you can have the aggravation when you're not here. So I said, and then right that year, 1970, I would have still been there because he would have still owned the club. He passed away.
Yeah.
He was like a second father to me, you know, a very, very tough. He was looked like a movie star. He looked like John Payne. He was a handsome Italian guy. He would take care of me. When we first started there, we were making $110 a week. And he said, you know, you're dressing like you're slobs. And I just looked at him. He said, this is the number. I want you, John, and I think it was Harvey Newmark was the bass player. I can't remember who it was. Either Harvey or Putter. He said, I want you to go downtown to a friend of mine. We went downtown, and we came out with Armani suits and shirts. And no bill. We never saw a bill. Money was never mentioned.
Yeah.
And then for a couple of years after that, we'd go down every couple of years and we'd do it again. Because I worked for him almost 13 years.
Wow.
1957 to 70.
Yeah.
And he passed away at the end of 69.
Yeah, you know, to me, L.A. was a pretty happening place when it came to nightclub and live music culture back in the day.
Sunset Strip. You could start at the west end of it, okay? You had the Melody Room, which is now, I think, the Viper Room, whatever it's called now.
Right, right.
But that was the Melody Room. And they had the Steinway B piano in there, and the piano bar seated 20 people that came around, and they always had trios. And Frankie Ortega played there, who ended up playing at 77 Sunset Strip for with Dino.
Right.
And he wrote that song, 77 Sunset Strip.
Oh, yeah.
Remember? Snap. And that's where that came from.
Wow.
But that was Dino's. There was the Melody Room. There was Laurel Inn. There was Sherry's. On La Cienega, Johnny Walsh's. Then it became the Regency.
Yeah.
And then the Winners and the Losers. Oh. And it went on. And it kept on going down. There was Jazz City was the greatest little big club. I don't think they ever had air conditioning in there, and everybody smoked. But they had a giant fan that blew the smoke out the front door, so it always looked like the place was on fire. I remember I saw, who was it? I saw there, John Coltrane, and it was a trio, piano, bass, and Coltrane.
Wow.
No, it wasn't Coltrane. It was Sonny Rollins. I take it back. It was Sonny. Mm-hmm. And it was a bass player and a piano player, and he told the piano player to lay out. And I'm sitting there, going, okay. But he would, you know, the place would be packed because it was Sonny Rollins, you know.
Yeah, Sonny Rollins, one of the great ones. Well, speaking of musician royalty, when we came to see you at the Baked Potato in October of last year, you were telling me a great story about Oscar Peterson and Sarah Vaughan.
That's still my favorite night at the club. And I happened to be there. You know, Suisse Edison played every Sunday for 3 or 4 or 5 years in a row.
Right.
And he always had great, great, great people playing with him. You know, Dolo Coker would play piano with him. And I remember Justin, who you heard sing, Justin said to me, "Dad, how come he's so dressed up? He would always come in a beautiful suit and tie and just be eloquent, you know, from the old day." And everybody else was, you know, not shabby, but kind of loosely dressed, you know.
Yes.
And but Dolo had to be, you know, this was Dolo.
Yeah.
And he had Jimmy Smith playing drums a lot of times. And I forget who the drummer, the bass player, I think Jimmy Bond did it a couple times, or Leroy Vinegar did it for a bit. But he didn't care for Leroy because Leroy wasn't really that style. I forget who it was. It wasn't Curtis Counts. I just don't remember. But that band was incredible.
Yeah.
And, of course, Harry Suisse Edison. And Oscar came in on a Sunday night, and I happened to be right at the door when he walked in, and was like, "Oh, God's here." And I immediately introduced myself, and I said, "How many are there?" He says, "It's just me." He says, "I'll sit with you." You know, I introduced myself and told him. Mm-hmm. And he looks over, and he sees the Steinway. He says, "Oh, I see you have a Steinway." I said, "That's there because of you." I had seen him play at the London House in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he used the Steinway B. And I said, if I ever have a club, I'm going to have a Steinway B. And that's what it was.
Wow.
And Sweets is saying, "Come on up, Oscar." He sees him immediately. Mm-hmm. And I keep saying, "No, no, no, no." And for the whole set. And finally, I'm begging him. I said, "You know, that piano, it's really yours." He says, "Okay, I want to do one song." I said, "Okay." And he started to go up, and here comes Sweets back with the band. "No," he says, "I'm just doing this for Don." And he starts to play, and you could hear a pin drop.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
But the good part, besides that being as fantastic as was, on the corner of the bar, right behind the piano, there was this gorgeous young black singer by the name of Sarah Vaughan. And she gets up, and she walks over, and he looks at her and says, "Sarah." She goes, "Oscar." And he gives her a big hug. And they did almost 30 minutes of duets.
Oh, my goodness.
And he and her singing together. And I never knew he could sing.
Yeah, he sounded a lot like Nat King Cole.
If it happened today, we would have had him recorded.
Oh, yeah.
To hear the two of them together. Oh, God. How precious.
Yeah, yeah. Stories like that that influenced me to do a series on the iconic clubs in L.A. that are still going strong. You know, I want to go back to this topic of the relationship of great jazz and classical musicians and their role in popular music. You know, there's George Martin and the Beatles, there's Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson, and of course, your fraternity, the Wrecking Crew. You know, these are unsung heroes to me. We applaud the artists, but not the musicians who actually played on the record.
You brought up Michael Jackson. I'll tell you an interesting story. We were doing a show with Nancy Sinatra at Amoeba.
Yeah.
This is some years ago, the Amoeba on Sunset Boulevard, which is now some show. But, after we finished, they were doing signings and stuff, and we were always sitting with Nancy and signing albums and stuff. And this young girl, about 9 years old, comes up with the Jackson 5 album. And she looks at me, and she's absolutely gorgeous. She's got to be 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "My dad said for me to come up and ask you if I would, would you mind signing my album?" And I looked at her. She says, "Because he said you played on ABC, and that's my favorite song." And she nearly made me cry. She was so gorgeous.
Oh,
and, so, and he's standing back. And I think he might have been a basketball player. He was about 6'10". He was this giant guy. And here's his little daughter coming over me. And, of course, I signed it. And she said, "Thank you, Mr. Randy." I said, "Oh, God." It was a wonderful moment. But it was, you know, those are the things you live for.
Yeah, but as someone who cut his teeth playing live, you know what it means to create that kind of energy on a recording. I mean, that certainly happened on ABC.
Live music to audiences that you never know where they're going to be coming from can be hell. It can be the worst, or it can be the absolute greatest night you'll ever have.
Exactly right.
Some nights, I try to explain this to some of the younger students that want to play live music. I said, don't expect the glory every night. Some nights the band will be so tight and so cohesive,
right?
And the audience don't get it. There's, you know, and then some nights the band will really suck, and then nobody's getting, you know, you're not, nothing's happening, and the audience is freaking out. They love it.
Yeah.
So what are you going to tell them? Don't applaud?
Well, you know, that to me is the thing of the performing arts. You know, I tell my students, I say, look, you're dealing with two different businesses. One is the performing arts and one is the recording arts, and they're entirely different. If you're in the recording arts, if you screw up, you can go back and fix it. In a live performance, you can't do that.
Yeah.
I firmly believe that the better you are at the performing arts, the better your recording career will go.
I totally agree with you, Greg. I think it gives you a better emotional feel of what's going on.
Well, you know, it's this thing of the performing arts. And, you know, to me, it's not about skill level. It's about how much of yourself you invest in what you're doing. And I can, you know, there have been so many times I've seen people who don't have a huge skill set, but you can see they're very emotionally invested in what they're doing. And that's a very satisfying performance.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that, in my opinion, doesn't get talked about much is that the original concept of recording was to capture a great performance. But as technology progressed and a bad performance could be fixed, I mean, you know, you have singers who can't sing that sound like geniuses, and musicians who can't play who sound like virtuosos. I mean, then the consumer is buying something that is not an honest performance. Yeah, it's processed by a machine, and it bothers me.
That's why we enjoyed when everybody was together in the same room, you know. It's so impersonal now. They'll send you a track, or you'll go in and nobody's there but you, and you're listening to either a click track or maybe part of the rhythm section. And the camaraderie and the essence of having the band together is lost completely, because it's so... I'm looking for the word, so sober, let's put it that way.
I think what you're saying is true, and it's not that it's gone. It's still out there. I do see it with with the newer generation of musicians. So it still exists. You know, people still want to get together and enjoy that camaraderie, as you said. It's just that the business of it, you know, it certainly leans more toward the technical construction of music.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on, Greg. You're right on. You know, and the process, as far as I'm concerned, I'd love to have a dime for every time somebody made a mistake on a session.
Yeah.
And everybody's, "Oh, who did that? Let's go with that. What was that?" You know? And it happens. It's happened over and over the years, you know. Oh, yeah. Or something will happen, or say, "Hey, let's try this." Or somebody will have a suggestion. But when you're alone, and you're not playing off anybody, and you're in a room and you're just overdubbing. I had an argument with a young guy doing an overdub. I had to keep doing this thing, and I made a mistake on one of the times through. And I said, "Can you just go back, and I'll just fix that part. It'll take 5 seconds. He said, "No, don't worry about it." And I said, "Come on, just go right back in 2 seconds. "No," he says, "Don, you played it right all the other times."
Hmm.
Cut and paste.
That was it. Well, like I said, it's more like the literary arts. It's really, yep. It's like writing a book. But it takes, it becomes sterile, you know.
It does.
You know,
it does.
Give me, put a bunch of people in a room. It's going to be messy, but guess what? You're either going to fall on your face. It's going to have passion and energy. Give me the passion and energy.
Sure. And, you know, that's called being a musician and enjoy it. I sometimes feel that anybody can do today's style of overdubbing. Whereas before, when you have to play with other people in the room, you have to consider other people in the room.
Oh, well said. That's true.
It's not action. It's just, it's reaction, you know?
Yes.
And it's like, hey, so I have a friend of mine who used to teach acting, and he says the hardest thing to teach to an acting student is to the reaction, not the action. You know, how do you react to everybody, you know? And that's musically is what happens. When it's right, boy, there ain't nothing like it.
Yep, that's true. And I'm sure it's that way for all performers. I mean, you know, whether it's acting, stand-up comedy, ballet, music, freestyle, rap, or dance. If it's live performance, give me that any time.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. Me too.
Well, Don, this has been a wonderful, 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 wonderful interview. I mean, you're very special to me because I've just known you for so long.
Thank you so much. You're special to me too. And what a pleasure it was to see you after all those years.
Yes. Man, the band sounded killer. I was honored to be there.
You're more famous than you think you are.
It was wonderful, Don. There was so much energy coming out of that band.
Oh yeah, that makes it for me that one day a month, boy, that I can get in there and let it out. It's terrific. It's terrific.
But Don, thank you so much for this interview, man.
My pleasure, and keep doing it, my friend.
Oh, I love doing it. It's a lot of fun.
All right, bye bye.
All right, take care. That interview took place on December 24th of 2021. Now, if you're curious about the records Don played on, Google him. That's Don, D-O-N, Randy, R-A-N-D-I. And if you want to go out for a wonderful evening of live music, the Baked Potato in Studio City is the place to be. Again, thank you for listening to Sonic Tonic, brought to you by the California Jazz Foundation. Please visit our website at californiajazzfoundation.org. and find out how you can make a difference in the life of a musician in need. Until the next one, this is Greg Perret wishing you all the best.